Now, I just want to say a couple of words about emotion here in our hymn singing. We are often accused of either denying we have any emotions as Lutherans, or you know, maybe we don't have. They really begin to wonder because we keep talking about this whole subject of emotions. Stay clear. Well, emotions do not beget faith. But this is true. When we sing these sung truths, they are ours. We believe them. We believe the promise. We are often overwhelmed by those truths. And emotion is a result. But we dare not switch that around and have as our goal emotion, or our starting point, because we are not going to be singing then about truth for our faith. Is that clear? So, while most of the church just might be putting this whole thing in this realm, and this is their goal, and then they don't have that result, but we are singing about this, and very often we have that as a result. I think you would be amazed to realize how much emotion actually is going on in a parish on Sunday morning, how many tears there actually are, especially when the hymns are rich. I'm sitting in a unique position at the organ, and I can see people, the choir is all around me, and they are facing me, and I can tell that. And they are singing a text, Behold a Host. Okay? I can name a whole list of texts where I know the singing of these truths are going to cause tears, but that's not why I chose the hymn. That's the difference. Okay? Now, we have a prayer book that fits us. You know, it's appropriate to be talking about this on Reformation because we are talking about a confession. We are a confessional church, one that fits us, and therefore the sung confession should also fit us, and God has given that to us. He has given us great gifts in this realm. One of the greatest would be Paul Gerhardt. I want to go through and show you a few of these great hymn writers and some of these texts and show you what kind of healthy food this is. And you can make your own comparisons later with other types of texts. But I just would like to hold up some that truly are unique. We're going to find in a Lutheran prayer book and not in other denominations. And Paul Gerhardt fits into that category. He was a Lutheran pastor, and it seems like his whole life was one of suffering and tragedy. One great sadness after another, and therefore he had to live that theology of the cross. Therefore he was able to write about it, and he gave us some of the finest texts that we have that are in any hymnal about the theology of the cross. Actually, in both parts of the theology of the cross. Let me explain that. one part of the theology of the cross, we learn how God works. We learn His ways. We learn that He chose to save the world through the opposite means of the way man would have done it. He chose it through humiliation and death of His own Son. It's all upside down from what we as man would have done. That cross and that cradle, that humiliation is really His glory. And that is one part of the understanding of the theology of the cross. And many of Paul Gerhardt's hymns fit that better than any other. They show us what shines there in that cradle. And it's not some, you know, sentimental kind of Christmas card type thing. This is our salvation in that cradle. And we see that picture so clearly. The other part of the theology of the cross is how God's ways relate to His own. How we are pruned, so to speak, by Him, by the vine dresser. How living the theology of the cross is how He strengthens His own. He toughens up the ones that He loves. I like the way Luther puts it. He said, think of just, if that vine could talk when the vine dresser is approaching, you know, and the vine dresser starts snipping away at the vine, and the vine calls out, it hurts in anguish. Are you going to kill me? And it just keeps snipping away. And in the end, it is all for the good of the vine. I think that is, that's a great picture that Luther paints there. And then Paul Gerhardt understands that and writes hymns about it. If you were to look, look at LW 423. Let's sing the first two verses of 423. When I suffer pains and losses, Lord, be near, let me hear comfort under crosses. Point me, Father, to the heaven, which your Son for me won when His life was given. Under burdens of cross bearing, though the weight may be great, yet I'm not despairing. You designed the cross you gave me. Thus you know all my woe and how best to save me. That's very, very wonderful. Hymn writing on this theology of the cross. You need, especially you, those of you who are going to go out and be pastors, you need to know where this type of hymn is in the hymnal. Your people, you're going to send them home with Bible passages. Send them home also with Him and list them. Specific verses, even. And you can't go wrong with any of the Gerhardt hymns. I had a dear friend who went home to heaven last last year, and she knew this whole section of the hymnal, Cross and Comfort section, inside and out. Actually, in here, this was her hymnal. And every night after supper, she would go in a room and she would sing hymns from this section of the hymnal. And toward the end of her life, when I went in one time, she was not in a good way at all. In fact, I thought she was going to die very soon. And I was having a hard time even getting her to communicate. And I started to sing, if Christ himself before me, I may a host defy. She turned her head and said, 528. That's the number out of here. Now, she knew it inside and out. She knew all those Gerhardt hymns. But now the other part of the theology of the cross, unfortunately, we don't have this hymn in LW, so I'll have to read it to you. You know, the other part, the theology of the cross, where we see God's glory in his humiliation. This is Gerhardt. This is hymn number 81 in TLH, one of the best hymns in this hymnal. O Jesus Christ, thy manger is my paradise, at which my soul reclineth. For there, O Lord, doth lie the Word made flesh for us. Herein thy grace forth shineth. He whom the sea and the wind obey doth come to serve the sinner in great meekness. Thou, God's own Son, with us art one, doth join us and our children in our weakness. And it goes on for four more stanzas. That is the kind of richness I'm talking about, where the incarnation is made so clear and beautiful, and the atonement and this theology of the cross. Another really great text, I think, is this Philip Melanchthon text that I passed out as you came in. Out of TLH. This is in LW, but they cut out four stanzas, and they're the four best ones. So that's why I decided to copy it out of here. I recently got in the mail a catalog, and it said on the, it has this banner of angels with all of these Bible passages in it, and it says right here. I thought this was interesting. At last, a decorative print that speaks the truth about angels. You know, and it goes on to say that angels are everywhere. They're in the, you know, calendars, books, and there's not a whole lot of truth out there about angels. My point here is that our hymns are teaching us the truth about doctrines. It may be the only place that our people are getting the truth about a doctrine like angels. Because it is really sad about, I think, what people are coming to believe about them, because they've become so popular and gone off in so many different directions. But I would like to sing this, because this tells us a wealth about angels. Lord God, we all to thee give praise, thanksgivings me to thee we raise, that angels host thou didst create, all round thy glorious throne to wait. They shine with light and heavenly grace, and constantly behold thy face. They heed thy voice, they know it well. In godly wisdom they excel. They never rest nor sleep as we. Their whole delight is but
but to be with the Lord Jesus and to keep my little flock by lambs and sheep. The ancient dragon is their foe, his envy and his wrath they know. It always is his aim and pride, my Christian people to divide. As he of old deceived the world, and into sin and death has hurled, so now he subtly lies in wait to ruin school and church and state. A roaring lion round he goes, no halt nor rest he ever knows. He seeks the Christians to demar and slay them by his dreadful power. But watchful is the angel band that follows Christ on every hand, to guard his people where they go, and break the counsel of the foe. For this now and in days to be, our praise the Lord will roar to thee, whom all the angel hosts adore, with grateful songs forevermore.
To ruin school and church and state. Isn't that interesting? You'll learn a lot from that little hymn. Another, yes.
This picks up on something I believe was in Protestant sermons, and is also evident here. People might admit that, yes, these are among the good songs. The times have changed, and they no longer fit us, and we can't sing as many verses as they used to. Obviously, something like that went into perhaps cutting it down from four, and even age is shortened from what it used to be. How could one respond to that?
Which part of that?
Yeah,
because
that, yes, these were good songs, and they are a good repertoire, but times have changed and no longer fit our needs, and therefore...
No. It's simply not true. What has changed? Is any of the stuff about the work of the devil changed since Melanchthon wrote it back then? And we can go back to the early church. This stuff is still with us. We need to be singing healthy truths that represent these unchanging things. I don't think we need to listen. I don't think it's wise to listen to all of these calls for change. Let the world change if it wants to. The church has always been slow to change until recently. But through most of its history, it has been very, very careful about what it has said, done, and sung when it gathered. And it has guarded it and not changed it lightly. But we have gone the other extreme now, where things are changed on a weekly basis. You know, there's nothing really stable. And we've got to come, we just cannot listen to those cries. I am convinced that the world is trying to tell the church how to be successful. And we are not to listen to the world. We are it. We are, the church in the world are not friends. That's how I would answer that. Now the long, you were another part of that. You said we can't sing long hymns anymore.
Well, are people who say that four verses is probably sufficient and they follow the fact to say it? I'm not sure what the argument is personally, but there's something about hymns are too long.
Well, I think, you know, even if I were to do a hymn like this in a service, I would break it up somehow. I really think that they're and even at the time of the Reformation, there, when they had a long hymn, 10 stanzas or whatever, there would be an alternating practice between back and forth between choir, or the organ would take a stanza, or and while the people meditated on that stanza. I mean, all the way back then, they did not count on the people's concentration for that long. I mean, just look what happens to our concentration during the Lord's Prayer. I mean, it doesn't take long. Then you give people a 15 stanza hymn, and they're going to be gone. I mean, they're not going to be with you as you get on into the maybe stanzas 6 and 7, 8, and by 15, forget it. You know. So I do think that we need to think about how we actually, sometimes it can actually break a hymn up and have a reading in between it or something. Then you come back in fresh for the remaining stanzas. Or this alternating procedure of having choirs or even having men and women, men of the congregation sing a stanza and women sing a stanza or whatever. It really helps. You want to keep their concentration there. But they certainly can sing hymns that are longer than four stanzas. Don't listen to that either. You may just have to work a little harder to keep the concentration there by the way that you set it up. Okay? That's a good point, though. Any other questions when we're stopped here? Okay. Another hymn that is just a model of law gospel discernment is Luther's favorite hymn, by the way, was by his friend Paul Sperattus, and that hymn is LW 355, Salvation Unto Us Is Come. I think that if you start looking in some other hymnals, I think you're going to realize how important it is to have the law gospel clearly clearly divided. It's not confused. This, you look at the first stanza and you see kind of an opening creedal statement here in that first statement that kind of sums up the whole hymn. But then, it's kind of like, you know, we're going to have two stanzas of law. Solid law. What God did in his law to men and none to him could render. It was a false, misleading dream. And there's no doubt in anyone's mind what that is. But then it is just the gospel shines right at the beginning of Christ has full atonement made and brought us. Each Christian therefore may be glad and build on this foundation. Your grace alone, dear Lord, I plead. Your death is now my life indeed, for you have paid the ransom. The gospel and then faith clings to Jesus Christ alone. That the gospel is clear. It is, there's no confusion. And that is no small point. Another hymn, actually is by one of the framers of the Formula of Concord, Nicholas Selnecker, wrote a hymn, 344. And in his hymn, he talks about living in the second stanza in the end time stress. The end time stress. And I think if you look at that whole stanza, rekindle for this end time stress, face ancient strength and steadfastness, that we keep pure till life is spent, your holy word and sacrament. The means of grace are clearly spelled out here. Then if you look in stanza 4, may glorious truths that we have heard, the bright lamps of your mighty words, spurn Satan, that your church be strong, bold, unified in act and song. I think, you know, this is another one where he is talking about the importance of a consistency between our confession and our practice. Another problem that we are having in the church these days is the separation of confession and practice. In other words, we have pastors who believe that as long as they've got it straight when they are in the pulpit, all is well. But everything else that goes on, in other words, the practice of the church, is not really going to be all that important or a significant teacher. Well, it just isn't true. When you start to confuse the people by separating those two, to tell you the truth, I have a hard time believing that it's going to probably be straight in the pulpit too. You know, if they've given up the whole practice, although there are many who do believe that they can, that it really is just, it needs to be straight from the pulpit, and then we get loose for the whole rest of it. You know, just let people kind of do kind of what they would like to do for the rest of it, and that just is not going to have the same importance. And yet, as I said before, that most might be the very words that people are go home with. And that actually memorize. And so it has to be consistent. You know, it's like he says in this hymn, bold, unified, in act, and in song, these glorious truths.
Verse 5.
Oh, the whole hymn is just a great hymn. It really is. Oh. It is truly this end time stress type hymn. It really is. Or as Walter was saying in that little quote I had before, in a time of confession. And this is the time of confession. Now, how do you find that? When the gospel itself is being questioned, is at stake, in even within the church. And this, you know, this is the kind of hymn that really fits. It's healthy for us to be singing in this time. You know, I could point out all kinds of Luther hymns, but I think I'm going to just mainly wait with Luther until the spring. But let me just show you an example of one. LW 37 and 38. His Christmas hymn of 15 stanzas is a beautiful, complete picture of what God has done for us in His Son. And here is a hymn where the gospel shines all the way through. Just like from now on, just start looking at how much gospel you see in Him. Start looking for it. I think you're going to see that you're going to see a lot more law. And then you're going to start to appreciate a hymn like this that is all about what God has done, the beauty of that. And yes.
This was originally one.
Mm-hmm.
thinking is that maybe a way to sing this would be to have a choir sing 37 and the congregation sing 38.
Mm-hmm.
And,
certainly.
Just back and forth.
Yeah.
First verse, second verse.
Yeah. See, there's all kind of, I could give you lots of ideas about that kind of thing. That's not really what I was going to get into much tonight. I just wanted to kind of point up how what a confession we do have in our song. But there are all kinds of ways that really help the people to enjoy and are able to do the hymn singing. You don't just give it to them and just expect that they can do it. But there are many ways of making this a rich part of their coming together. Yes, sir.
If we want to hold this or PLA of it as a prayer book, something around which we construct the way we even think about God and worship, can you comment as to why then do we turn to our youth and give them the dribble of enmity that we give the youth of the church today? It just seems to me that the songs I learned in Sunday school, I wouldn't even go so far as to call them loose. They were the watered-down, reformed, pan-Christian type of music, and didn't serve to teach me this kind of meaning too. The only song I can think of that I think is simple and yet very rich is Jesus Loves Me, or the Bible tells me. Why do you think it is that we as a church, in a very timid, seem to sell short of youth in a way of thinking?
Okay, when we start talking about youth, that's an excellent point, by the way. When we start talking about youth, let's not talk about teenagers, because then it's too late. We've got to back up. Now, if we try to start to bring these things to our teenagers as pastors with confirmation class or whatever, you know, it's too late. Forget it. But what we need to do is with our very young children to be in every opportunity we have with them to be giving them this good food. I really mean it. It's not the easy route. In fact, it's the hard route. Although the children don't know it's hard. They don't know what's hard. If I got down on the floor with them and sang Isaiah Mandy Sear and was really excited about it and wanted to give that to them, they would do it. I know they would do it. But if I stand up and I'm negative and say, oh, this is a hard thing, I'm not sure you're going to be able to get it. You see, the teaching is everything, but then the teachers also have to fight kind of the voices around them that somehow think that this is not fun. And we're very much into fun these days in the church, it seems. It's beyond me. It's totally beyond me, but that word, fun, will be used as an argument, as if we are trying to deny them something, and yet we are trying to give them something for the rest of their life. That even if during those teenage years they might leave it for a while, they will have something to come back to when they pass through those few rebellious years. They've got something to come home to. Okay.
I was serving vicar. I was appointed as the EDS director. Part of overseeing EDS was the music program there, and ran into a lot of hostility when I tried to change what had been done in the past. And in this case, they used PLA, and I was trying to use the hymns from the PLA for the children. And I met with a lot of hostility. And as a vicar, I told I should. But anyway, this comment came up from my discussion. To a child, everything is contemporary. They wanted to use contemporary music. And I said, they don't know that this was written in the 16th century. It's contemporary to them. They're learning it anew, as if it were written yesterday. So I think that's something that, for little children.
Yeah.
For little children, every song is a contemporary song.
So you didn't get any opposition from the children?
No, I did not.
And you won't. You won't. If you've got good teaching and you're trying to give, you give them something of worth, they know something of worth. They really do. The opposition comes from the adults. It is amazing. But is this worth the battle? I think it is. We're talking about the future of our church here. Either we're giving our children something and they're going to be the future, or we're not. You know, there's this understanding of coming home to the hymnal, but coming home this time with understanding. And that goes for all ages. Yes.
That's a great point. I've very much been sympathetic with what you're saying, that emotion doesn't lead to faith. And I've gone to worship in another church and another denomination in another city. And sometimes when I've gone there, I think I have to pray that I'll not get cynical, because they use music to stir up the emotion, to get you going for the greatest show on earth type of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And I very much appreciate not manipulating the emotion to try to create. On the I recall Jonathan Edwards, in his book Religious Affection, was trying to explain, on one hand, the excesses of the Great Awakening in the 1740s, where a lot of persons were emotionally stirred up by the revival, and then when the emotions were gone, they had nothing to show. On the other hand, the divines of Boston, who wanted to hold the dead orthodoxy, the intellect, without any content. And to respond to these two poles, Jonathan Edwards talked about the religious affection. And I was wondering if it's a helpful thing to look at the hymn in that context, the pole between emotion on one hand and whole intellect on the other.
Well, I don't think that this is, as I described here, I don't think that this is just the realm of just the intellect. I mean, this is, there is definitely emotion there. There is this, you know, I don't see, as you said, the intellectual realm without the content.
You said
that is the new song of faith. Is it not? The new song is not some new thing that somebody composed. The new song is that which we can now sing because of faith. Those are really the words that God has put in our mouth. So I think that you could call it the new song of faith. Okay? Well, I could give you lots of examples of, you know, these are not all just 16th century. They're not all just German. Okay? I mean, I could go through and show you healthy texts from different countries, and even from much, much earlier. I mean, we can come all the way to the present with Martin Franzmann, with Thy Strong Word. You know, and you've got a strong theology of the cross there with Thy, from the cross, Thy wisdom shineth. You know, they are still writing some good hymns. And I just, in fact, I have one of our graduates is a pastor in Connecticut, Pastor Steve Starkey, and he is writing wonderful hymns. And he just sent me, let me just show you an example of a contemporary hymn. It was just written last year, and yet it fit all of these guidelines that I've been talking about. It what mercy God showed to our race, a plan of rescue by His grace, in sending one from woman's seed, the one to fill our greatest need. For on a tree uplifted high, His only Son for sin would die, would drink the cup of scorn and dread to crush the ancient serpent's head. Now from that tree of Jesus' shame, flows life eternal in his name. For all who trust and will believe, salvation's living fruit receive. And of this fruit, so pure and sweet, the Lord invites the world to eat, to find within this cross of wood the tree of life with every good. That is, you know, people often do complain, why aren't people writing new hymns to fit your guidelines? Why aren't they doing it? Well, we don't have, it takes gifts. We don't get a Paul Gerhardt, you know, every 200 years. I mean, it takes really a gift of being able to write a text, and I think it's even harder to write a tune that's going to last. I mean a good tune, like a, you know, For All the Saints tune or something like that, that really is going to live on. I just don't come along. But we do have this rich body already that does fit us. And so I would ask you to think about catechesis, including this prayer book, teaching, and coming home to the prayer book, but this time with understanding.